Anybody else, anyone else waiting to speak?
Mayor Parr?
Yes, sir.
My name's Tom Scott. I'm the Executive Administrator of the Southern Region Emergency Medical Services Council, which is based here in Anchorage and covers, is responsible for the planning and implementation of the emergency medical services programs in south central, southwestern Alaska. We're an agent, we're a nonprofit corporation with a board of directors of 35 people representing all of the area, including the Aleutian Chain, Copper River Valley, Prince William Sound, Kenai Peninsula, Kodiak, Seward Peninsula, and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, Mat-Su Borough, and the Anchorage Municipality of Anchorage. We receive our funds from the State of Alaska Department of Public Division of Public Health, the Emergency Medical Services Section. My purpose in testifying today is just to bring the committee up to date on what we've been doing in this region with the funds that we receive from the legislature. First thing I want to do is I want to thank the committee and Senator Parr especially for his ongoing support of EMS in the state of Alaska, which dates back some 5 or 6 years, at least to my knowledge, and I'm sure before that. Southern region serves the largest section of the state and consequently has the largest staff of the regional organizations. We have a staff of 10, including 5 EMT trainers, one nurse who's responsible for developing continuing education for nursing personnel in the 17 hospitals in our area, and then four-person administrative slash clerical staff. My role is, as the executive administrator, is primarily the administration, but also the work with the regions in their efforts to the sub-areas that we have, 10 sub-areas, in their planning efforts and providing the technical assistance they need in improving their organization for the delivery of their services. Helping them develop their regional, their annual implementation plans and so forth. I brought along a copy of the President's Report, which Ms. Billy Peters, the President of our Board of Directors, or the immediate past President, presented at our annual board meeting on November the 12th, which I'd like to submit to the committee. It gives a brief thumbnail sketch of the accomplishments that Southern Region has obtained over the last 5 years of its existence of the federal funds that we had at that time and are currently in our first year of state funding. I think a particular note, I think, is that some of the things that we're proud of is the fact that when we started in 75, there were 11 ambulance services in our region, which were manned by basic emergency medical technicians. Today, there are 29 such services, most of which are trained to the EMT-2 level, all but 3 of which are volunteer services.
You said volunteer. May I interrupt? Volunteer services. Do you mean? Is it all but 3 of which are volunteer services? Do you mean that there are 3 EMTs who are paid, or there are 3 services where everybody is paid, or how do you?
3 ambulance services that are full-time paid.
Everybody's paid.
Everybody's paid.
Okay.
And the rest are volunteer. One of the other things is the fact that in 75 there was only one city that in this region that had 911 telephone number. Today, 10 of the 13 major communities have 911.
What is the advantage of 911 except for the fact that if somebody moves from one place to another, they know that's always a standard number and they don't have to worry about learning a new one?
The quick access to, it's easier to dial in the dark, in a hurry.
The reason I'm asking that, we used to have 118, as I remember, where I lived.
Right.
That was a standard number. That was when you called for any emergencies. You know, I just didn't know what the advantage of 911 was over 118. Unless there's some advantages to having a statewide number that, you know, people will move around.
Right. The only advantage in that case is it's the standard number that for people who move around, they know it, and once they go from place to place, it becomes fixed in their minds easier.
Yeah, so now you say 10 of the 13 other major communities have 911, and the three that don't have it for what reason?
Financial.
I don't understand. Just figure I don't know anything. Tell me from scratch. Why is it financial? What's the big deal about changing an emergency number, you know, except by somebody rearranging some wires in a telephone central or something? I mean, whatever. What's involved that makes it expensive?
The old switching equipment, most of the cities that have 911 now have installed new computerized switching, which makes it, there it's merely a matter of switching a few wires. The old-fashioned switching where they had the relays that were clicking closed with each thing made it, I'm not sure exactly what involved, but that's what was the major. It cost a lot of money to alter that system from a 7-digit system to a 3-digit system. And so it was, that was the major reason why things weren't happening before. And then, and I think is now, because of the new computerized switching that most of the places are putting in, they're able to add 911 as they go along. With the help of the, with the support of the community that has to get together. And for example, the reason Kenai and that Soldotna are just coming online now was because it was, they cover an area that overlaps city boundaries and so forth, and the telephone exchanges don't match the governmental boundaries and the service area boundaries, and they needed that legislation that was passed this year to allow them to form a separate organization to set up a dispatch and thereby allow a central 911 system with one dispatcher dispatching all of the police, fire, and so forth in that area.
Hope you don't mind being interrupted.
No, please.
Clarify these things, points we're going.
In 1975, there were no advanced cardiac life support trained personnel in the region's hospitals. Today, all the facilities have a physician or a nurse in the emergency room who has probably had this advanced cardiac life support training, which has been developed by the American Heart Association, too, so that those personnel can manage the cardiac case much more effectively and save some lives. In the past year, we were happy to train some new responders in Cold Bay, Sandpoint, and St. Paul, all of which are communities that, Cold Bay and Sandpoint had received grants from the legislature this year for ambulances, and St. Paul put up $25,000 of their revenue sharing money to buy an ambulance for themselves. After we were able to provide them some EMT training this year, providing services to those communities. We're also able to put a new ambulance on the Glacier View, at Glacier View, it's about mile 100 on the Glen Highway, working with the Mat-Su Borough, which provided the vehicle, and we provided the training for them to fill up one more gap in the highway system, which leaves about another 100 miles to Glen Allen of uncovered area. And then we are assisting this year the Soldotna. In the Soldotna area, the voters in the last election have voted to set up an ambulance service district, which includes the Soldotna Kenai area, to have a single unified ambulance service there. And they've assessed themselves a 1 mil tax, property tax, in order to provide that service. And we're working with those folks to help them get organized and to provide a full-time ambulance service in that area. Another, our other major effort that Southern Region's involved with is a planning process using the Alaska EMS goals, which were developed with staff from Southern Region and modified by the state EMS office and adopted by the state advisory council as reasonable goals according to community levels. We are have a process that begins at the grassroots level. We have 10 sub areas. Each of those has a designated coordinator. Most of them have an EMS council that is representative of the providers and consumers in their area, who develop their operating plans of what they would like to accomplish during the next year. That plan comes up to our board of directors. We work together as a group to look at what operating monies are available from the state and develop a plan that will, within those constraints, to carry out our activities for each of the years. We work very closely with the Native Health organizations, who in this area have over $1 million of Indian Health Service money designated for EMS. Each of the health corporations has a full-time person doing EMS coordination. And it really extends our effectiveness. A couple of the issues that we're facing now, and we'll be looking at very carefully, and those that maybe I think the legislature would be interested in, is number one is the status of the Indian Health Service funding. We anticipate a 10% to 20% cut next year in the amount of money that's available from the Indian Health Service for the Emergency Medical Services Program. Our planning process this year is including a whole extra day of just brainstorming among ourselves on how we're going to deal with that whole issue. I know the health corporations individually are looking to the state to pick up not only that cut, but the across-the-board 20% cuts that they're facing in the delivery of their services. Another area that we're looking at is the issue of EMT certification and the support for that. This year, this is January 1st, our EMT certification regulations will become effective. And those certification regulations require the state to provide all of the testing for certification of basic EMTs, twos and threes, on a biennial basis. Our training staff, which has been doing training up to this point in time, is now being put in a position of test monitors. There'll be certifying officers required to go out and monitor the examination at the site. The travel funds for that will be coming out of our operating budget, that which we've been using for training in the past.
Tom, you mind if I interrupt with a question?
Sure.
Okay. There are a couple of areas. I received this, by the way, from Billy just yesterday, so I appreciate getting another copy here. I wanted to ask you some questions related to the training staff and to the whole area of training and paramedics and skill decay, this whole complex here. One of the issues that's been debated in Fairbanks, in fact, there was a meeting, I think it was Friday, in which this was brought up, is this whole question of you know, paramedics, as to whether or not paramedics are a necessary addition to various emergency medical services, particularly in the non-urban, or specifically the non-Anchorage and non-downtown Fairbanks areas. The reason I bring it up in this context is that one point being made is that a paramedic per se would be an excellent person, everything else aside, to act as a trainer for EMTs 2 and 3. And also that there are some other functions that a paramedic could provide. However, I gather that there has also been some real concern about skill decay, particularly in the case of paramedics who are highly trained to provide emergency medical services, but of a kind that perhaps are not as frequently needed here in Alaska as you might see, say, in Los Angeles. Could you make some general comments on this? First of all, could you comment on whether or not paramedics would be appropriate to offer training to EMTs 2 and 3? And secondly, this whole question of skill decay, particularly in terms of paramedics, but also in terms of the EMTs 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm. Skill decay is a problem, and it's been our Southern Region, the training staff at Southern Region has taken the lead in the development of these 2 and 3 intermediate levels for the very reason that paramedic, before it was just basic EMT and then there was paramedic, and a paramedic is a person who's had, you know, basically 6 months of 40 hours a day, 5 days a week of training, and is trained to deal with most every type of emergency with drugs, a whole array of drugs, and sticking chest tubes into people, and doing all types of things that have traditionally been limited to doctors and hospitals. At the time when we just had the basic EMT is just basically an advanced first aider who knows how to really, is an advanced first aider for the most part, who can handle a bunch of equipment, extra ambulance type equipment, is trained to deal with that. We developed the EMT2 course as a person who can start an IV and put some fluids into people who have lost blood, and that is extremely important in preventing shock, which is a major killer in accidental death and injury, and is their major problem in outside of Anchorage. You don't see a lot of cardiac in the rural areas. And then we went on to the EMT3, and for some of the more urbanized rural areas, which is a person who, when basically the person has had, is in the stage of his heart attack where he's dead. His heart is not producing any blood flow. It's fibrillating. It's a real easy rhythm to recognize on a cardiac monitor and shock the person and give maybe one drug, and that's the only case. The paramedic can look at all types of heart disease, and people who are having a heart attack but they're not unconscious yet, and they can recognize what the problem is with the heart and administer the appropriate array of drugs. Requires a lot of skill maintenance, and we agree that it's not appropriate for any areas outside of Anchorage. Nikiski Fire Department, because of the nature of their wealth, went ahead and went to a paramedic level, and in talking to people down there now after about a year, more or less agreed that they probably went too far, that they're just not seeing the patients that where they're really using their paramedic skills. So we're finding that there's more and more support nationally as well as locally, and the research done nationally is that the 3 is what's appropriate for a rural urbanized area, and that the skill decay is not that much of a problem for that level of training, because it's fairly straightforward mechanical response.
You say rural or urbanized area, I'm afraid I'm with you. Give me some examples of it.
Homer, Soldotna, Seward, Nikiski, a town.
Okay, small towns.
Small towns. On the issue of paramedics as trainers, our staff, save one, are all paramedics. Our staff are full-time trainers. While they're not practicing their skills in the field, although they try and ride occasionally with, say, the Anchorage Fire Department, And when they're in a community doing the training, they ride with the volunteers. Their constant refreshing and providing a course seems to meet their needs for skill and knowledge maintenance type of thing, although they are not doing the whole array of advanced cardiac procedures. And in a case where we have a full-time training staff, I think it's really important. I think it's valuable. I think the training that we do is, in trying to look at it objectively, is probably the best that's done in the state. And I think we've got the, there's other measures that can back us up on that. As far as issue of training, having a paramedic in a smaller town or rural area who's become trained as a paramedic because he's going to be doing training in the area is a question that it sounds appealing, but I'm not sure if the benefit is worth the cost on it.
If someone is to train an EMT 2 and 3, who would this individual be if not a paramedic? A physician?
The regulations require that they be a paramedic or a nurse or a physician,
okay.
PA.
Okay.
I think right now we're looking at most of the EMT 3 training that's been done so far has been done by our staff.
Who are paramedics.
And I know that there's a course scheduled in Seward soon at the Vocational Technical Center there, and that is a nurse anesthetist who is running that course and who's on staff there doing EMT training. The demand for EMT 3 is not that.
Isn't that?
Because of the limited number of communities where it's appropriate.
Would you say then probably the demand for paramedics would be even more limited?
Oh, yes.
Okay, and one final question. I understand that paramedics used to be, there was a course training paramedics here in Alaska, or perhaps two at one time, but these have been discontinued. One, I believe, was at the University of Alaska here in Anchorage.
Right.
And the other slips my mind at the moment where that was supposed to have been, or perhaps it was just contemplated.
There was, the Nikiski Fire Department hired somebody to come in and do their training for them.
Okay.
But the only other paramedic training course was done at the Anchorage Community College, and it was done by the Anchorage Fire Department because they needed people for their own to meet their needs. And since that time, they've had enough people who have been trained outside to come to Alaska and are on their way. They have a waiting list of 20 or 30 right now, and they have not felt any need to offer any training.
Thank you.
Ms. Sullivan?
Just from my own enlightenment, do you need a breakdown as to understand paramedics? Would you say 6 months, 40 hours a week to get that type of certification?
Right.
Okay. How long does it take, for example, for EMT 1?
EMT 1 is 81 hours, at least 81 hours. EMT 2 is an additional 50 hours. EMT 3 is an additional 24 hours. And there's a requirement of 6 months of service between each of those levels before you can go on to the next level. In Anchorage, the training, EMT 1 training is conducted in Anchorage at the community college. We provide, Southern Region provides training outside of Anchorage, and we go to the communities and provide for the volunteers and whatever schedule that they can fit in is the schedule we work with. Generally, an EMT course goes for 3 weeks, 3 weekends and evenings every night. For 3 weeks for a basic EMT course.
Are those required of a fireman,
It's not required of firemen. Many of the fire services
might offer it.
I offer it. Right.
Okay.
Sorry I was late, but I was in the other room, and then they told me 2:30 and on the phone. Could you give me an understanding on page 4, 5, and 6 of your breakdown?
Okay.
I was in the
Okay. Students are the number of students who started out the course, and the number of students completed is the number who completed our course, and certified is the number who went on to, for the cases of the EMT-3 and EMT-2, they have to serve an internship after the completion of the course before they are actually certified. EMT-2s have to do 10 IVs in real people under the supervision of somebody. And
so we assume there's a time involvement there,
right,
when they got certified.
Right, and then the others are pretty self-explanatory. That's a total... The total in the last column is the total we've trained, but since over the years. It's
the total really today, you have 8 here, say, for Kodiak.
Right.
So that means 8 for that class or 8 for that particular year that we're trained?
I mean, that means 8 for that. Well, that means 8 that were trained by us during that year.
And then the 19 means total in that community that are up to that grade.
No, this is in the region. We have trained 19 totally in all communities to that date.
That's accumulated total.
Right.
In March, you'd gotten us 19, in April, you'd gotten 25, and
you got 28 when you hit Barra, right?
So right. And it's the... And we trained a total of 18. So when you get down to Kenai there in May, we trained a total of 18... EMT-3s during that year that have been certified.
So if I want to know how many EM-3s were in Kodiak, could I go by this report?
No.
Anyway?
No. We don't have it. This report does not break it down by community other than it shows what community we did a class in and how many took the class in that community in that particular time. But these cumulative totals reflect the agency activity totals.
Okay. Pretty ignorant, say, when you say total to date, and you have 19 for Kodiak, 25 for Homer, Barrow, 28 and
33, 49. Look on the left-hand column, you get the date
okay.
Over there.
The total to date is...
March, they had gotten 19 for the year. In April, they hit 25, and then they had 3 more and got 28. Isn't that what it runs on that column?
Okay, total to date is a total who have completed the course, and then there's the total certified. Total to date, and that say after, on that first line, it says 19. That means as of March of this year, or... Yeah, this was as of last March, we had trained a total of 19 EMT-3s in the history of our organization in the state, or in our region. And we had just completed a course, and we had trained 8 that year, during that fiscal year. And the Kodiak was the first course that was done during that fiscal year, FY81.
Then there was additional, say, when you go down to April on Homer, 25.
Right. Then we trained 14 more, or 6 more in Homer, mm-hmm. bringing that year-to-date total to 14 and our okay. total in the history of the organization to 25. And then the next column is just those that are certified. But this is yearly to date is the amount trained during FY 81, I mean. And total to date is total trained since we started the EMT-3 program that we have trained. And you'll see that it's not, the numbers aren't very high when you look at EMT-1 on page the last page. It's $1,319.
That means statewide, we have that money.
Oh no, we have much more than that. This is just what our organization has trained.
Oh.
We have, and we just cover the south central part of the state.
That's what I was trying to get in my mind, Mr. Chairman, how many statewide we have covered in different categories. Mm-hmm. Because I also know that the public health service does a tremendous amount of training, and they underqualify, and by the title village aid, but there's people who are well qualified in medical procedures and all. Often worry about overlapping and overlapping with different training courses going on.
We have done most of the village health aid training at the for the emergency medical technician, and that the ones that we have trained are reflected in these totals.
You have nothing to do with the vaccinated hospital training program under Dr. Nick Wilson. Well, Dr. Wilson used to be Dr. Johnson.
Yeah. Right. Dr. Johnson's now with the rural ed. It's can picture him, I can't think of his name. At any rate, we do work with them. But we work the health corporations do most of the EMT training, and that's who we really work closely with. They all have EMS coordinators who are all, and they're all on our board of directors, and we respond to them directly.
Mr. Chairman, you may have another question with the program for the future. Are you working any with the University of Alaska, Loon, Alaska, and especially with the medical programs that they're starting within the degree of medicine, even for nurses that are starting into advanced degrees and all?
We're looking to the Loon, Alaska network to meet our continuing education needs in the rural areas. The EMTs are required to do 48 hours of continuing education over a two-year period. The Prince William Sound Community College right now, working with the Valdez Fire Department, is working on developing some demonstration tapes and program to try on the network. And we're going to look at, we have a real broad selection of training materials on videotape now that we are hoping to get on that network, and we've met with those folks. We really think it has a lot of potential. We're trying to be looking to get some funds from the public Division of Public Health to go at it a little in a more professional way next year than we've been able to this date. For now, it's just trying to put together programs on a haphazard basis. And we're not ready. We haven't gone on the air yet, of course, and it won't be until after the first of the year before we get time and so forth. But we really look to that as a way of meeting this continuing education need, which is really important because they don't have the call volume to maintain their skills on their own.
Mr. Scott, in your region, what are your gaps?
Our gaps right now are communications primarily, and on the highway system and in the bush are real major gaps. We have some spots on the highway system that are we'd like to cover better with ambulances. Primarily up on the Tope Cutoff, the Glen Highway between Glen Allen and Glacier View, probably at Eureka, and then down the Richardson's towards Thompson Pass are our gaps in covering the highway. We have a continual problem with the Northern Seward Kenai Peninsula in terms of covering the highway. There's not many people down there, and it's a tremendous volume of traffic. We are looking at the feasibility of a helicopter ambulance program based in Anchorage to service that area right now. It's very expensive, however, and at this current time won't fly on a from a private enterprise standpoint at all, and would need a heavy state subsidy to operate. But the communications, given the services we do have now, they, on the Kenai Peninsula down to Seward, they're, and from basically from Portage to Soldotna and down to Seward, the communications are very spotty in there, and there's no microwave link plan that will enable us to, right now. Troopers are happy with theirs, so they're not asking for anything in microwave. And then we need something going from Palmer to Glen Allen, coverage along that portion of the highway. Those are our highway communications gaps. There are areas planned. We do have plans for from Palmer to up the Parks Highway. That's being covered with a joint deal with the Alaska Railroad.
I will ask you a question because almost every time I get a presentation on this, people talk almost entirely about EMTs and training. I realize, of course, people are the key element, but it looks to me like you've got to have trained people, communications, and transportation, right? Those are the three things you've got to have. And everybody always, unless I ask them specifically, nobody ever mentions it, gaps in transportation and communications. In your paper here, it says, it's on page 3, I think, next to the last paragraph, each facility, which I guess is a hospital,
right,
either has physicians in the emergency room 24 hours a day, or the on-call physician has VHF radio contact with the hospital and the ambulance. Well, if that's true, the acting administrator at the Palmer Hospital yesterday didn't know it. She told us that they do not have that. First place, they've got, for one part of the area, they've got a, what we used to call a mask. You can't get radio contact.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, they do not have somebody on in the hospital all the time. And the physician who they call does not have contact, you know, with the ambulance. So I don't know, I mean, maybe either she doesn't know or else the statement's not 100% accurate. I don't know which it is. But I asked a specific question yesterday when we were out there. Nancy, correct my memory if I'm wrong. Yeah, right? Yeah. So, I don't know. That's what we were told.
Okay. Well, that's true. That statement is not accurate. I was taking into account the fact that we, there's $7,500 that's already been appropriated for radio system for Palmer. In fact, I talked to the administrator yesterday to make the final arrangements to go out to bid on that package.
They're going to put up, put it someplace where it won't be masked.
Mm-hmm.
Another question I'd like to ask is one that doesn't seem to bother anybody except me. Every time I mention this, even to my staff people here, I get sort of poo-pooed on it. But I'm still concerned about the liability question. As I understand it, right now in the state statutes, we have three different definitions of what constitutes a Good Samaritan exclusion from liability. That doesn't seem to make too much sense,
mm-hmm,
to me at least, as a country boy. And times I've asked people in EMS about this, I've never gotten any satisfactory suggestions either. Is it a problem in your region? Is it not? Do all these people have an insurance coverage which is adequate and affordable? Maybe it's a problem. Maybe I'm fighting a problem that doesn't exist, or it doesn't exist in, you know, wide, not, maybe it's not widespread in the state.
I believe that it's not that great of a problem, either in this state or nationally. Most of the ambulance services have a general liability policy that covers their malpractice as well.
Well, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, obviously.
Right.
That's part of,
right,
part of it.
The
what does it cost when these volunteer ambulance groups? I suppose you've got one in Sutton. Mm-hmm. I don't know where you got one, but Sutton or Soldotna or where it happens to be, or Seward or some other place. They got a, one of these volunteer outfits, right? And the state furnished them an ambulance. You've been training them. They're all volunteers. What does it cost them per year for coverage so that no one of them could be sued and lose his home or everything he's got for trying to be helpful, you know, as a volunteer?
I'm not sure what it costs a service in general. The state did a survey last year on that, and it wasn't a problem for the general liability. I do know that there are, that EMT, individual EMT malpractice insurance costs $50 a year from a national agency that provides malpractice insurance.
Is that paid for by the state?
To individuals. It's not paid for by the state. It's general.
Individual who volunteers just by himself for malpractice.
If he chooses to expand a coverage beyond what he's provided by the service, or in many cases they just assume the Good Samaritan Act will cover them, which for the, and there's,
you know,
questions
driving,
have been raised that that's not going to cover.
I'm going to drive from here on back home to Fairbanks, and I might have a car wreck out there somewhere beside Talkeetna, somewhere out really out. And I'm going to rely on some volunteers to take time out of their normal work and recreation activities to pick me up and get me into a hospital where I can, where my life can be saved. It doesn't appear to me to make much sense to put any kind of burden on those people. It shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm understanding you to say is that they have to buy, in addition to volunteering and taking this training and volunteering their time and everything else, that they also have to buy a policy to protect themselves.
But they don't.
They don't.
They don't.
And why the $50? How's it?
Well, I was just getting that as a typical cost of malpractice insurance, but as a rule, it's not a concern to the volunteers. They're not worried about being sued. And the case law in the lower 48 as well as up here indicates that they're not being unreasonable, that the cases against EMTs who act in a reasonable and prudent manner are almost, they're virtually nothing compared to other areas of malpractice, the rate, the incidence of successful cases against EMTs. And in this case, there's only one that I know of that's pending, and that's the only one that I know of, no successful case against an EMT in this state. I only know of one case, that maybe two, that tested the Good Samaritan law, and those were against a trooper off duty. It's not a problem that I hear anybody worry too much about. They depend on the Good Samaritan law. And in the case, and it's, there's some legal people who say that the Good Samaritan law for EMTs and for professional personnel or hospitals and so forth probably is unconstitutional because it violates the Equal Protection Amendment. The original Good Samaritan law that covers a person, the true Good Samaritan, is probably an effective law, but EMTs have set themselves up with a duty to respond and therefore are liable, are not covered, not, the courts could rule against them as Good Samaritans. But I think the issue of malpractice insurance has never been raised to me as an issue that people are concerned about. And the state is providing $2,500 a year mini grants to each of the volunteer services to help them pay for their general liability, which covers their malpractice as well for the service. And most people are grateful for that. It's helping the support, but hasn't been raised as a problem, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I said I've been first raised in me by somebody from my area. Mm-hmm. And I started looking into it and discovered we had three different Good Samaritan Acts on the books, some of which are based on danger to life or limb, mm-hmm. Based on other things. And it seems to me, I'm not sure, I don't remember which at this minute, which one applies to EMTs. But what the EMTs are covered on is not the same thing, for example, would cover somebody else. It would cover me. I'm not an EMT. As far as you're concerned, it's not a problem in South Central. One final question. I believe you said a while ago that you really can't, at least this is what I made a note of, you can't justify paramedics except in Anchorage. By that, I assume that you mean that the paramedic who actually goes out on an ambulance call primarily for cardiac arrest cases, and that there isn't enough volume in most other places to let him keep his skills up. That's what you were talking about, what
yes,
you were saying? Okay. I'm not sure I understood that.
If I know, as far as our loyal community, which I feel they have fairly good coverage and with our village aides and all, are they given that primary education in cardiac arrest and all kinds of good things like that? Would they fight on a borderline of paramedics because they give drugs according to the doctor's discussion over the phone or the radio or whatever?
They can give some drugs, but they're not trained for in cardiac, in the critical cardiac episode that a paramedic is trained to. The paramedic training involves about a 6-month training program, intensive program. The health aid program is 13 weeks over a 2-year period. The health aid is really trained more as the eyes and ears, my understanding, of the physician over the radio. And they're not trained the pharmacology, they're not given all the training to make the decisions to do things. They're taught how to do them and how to ask the right questions and recognize some primary care things. The emergency care course that they get is a 2-week course that's strictly, almost totally didactic, with some experience in the emergency room over here. And our experience has been they like the EMT course much better when we give it to them, because our EMT course is really oriented towards putting your hands on people and doing the things to stop bleeding and so forth. But it's...
Something like that goes through Long Alaska?
No. It's a real... It's EMTs are very skill-oriented. And most of our training involves we use lots of mannequins and lots of hands-on practice. And it's real hard to do something like that over TV.
So it would more let the TV be upgrading than the initial.
Right.
Would it be possible to get from you, Mr. Scott, not this minute, but at your convenience, you could just send it on down to us from Juneau. I assume you've got some kind of a map of your region.
Yes, sir.
Sort of basic map. To have shown on there in red for transportation gaps, blue for communication gaps, or any way you prefer to do it, I don't really care. But where those gaps are.
Sir, Bill.
I haven't seen it. Well, maybe that's maybe the House got it. You know, a sentence always left out. The other thing I did have a question that occurs to me in it. Have you what sort of arrangements are made between the regions, such as yours in the northern and the southeastern regions, for the things that sort of cross the boundaries? Do you have a protocol? Are there agreements made on those things, for example? You
yes,
mentioned
sir.
In your this paper you gave us, for example, you mentioned you had agreements with the transfer agreements between some of these units and the federal and hospitals and so forth have been able to, obviously, but you know, you've got a boundary somewhere between you and one of the regions. How about something that happens on that, around that boundary? Do you have some kind of formalized agreements as to what, who takes responsibility, who does what, et cetera?
Because our regions aren't directly involved in operating, we as regions don't have agreements on, formal agreements on what, if on an operational matter. But the ambulance services in that section, when their service boundaries come, most of the ambulance services, and I don't know of any that don't, on the highway system, have mutual aid agreements with the next service up the road in either direction.
Let me rephrase my question then. Does your office, since you're in charge of the region, does your office make sure that all of the operating agencies on these boundaries then do have such agreements?
Yes, sir. Yes, we do.
Okay. That's the key thing I'm trying to find out. Are there provisions made where you would cross over boundaries, right?
Right.
Yes, sir.
That brings up a case that Senator Parker's, when he's lined up in Fairbanks, and that it happened. I'm wondering if it's still a problem with inside where evidently the Fairbanks part of the Fairbanks Department wouldn't go up north. Then eventually they got, there was an accident, the troopers were the ones that called in.
Oh, they had a volunteer outfit. It was the
The Glacier people?
It was the Chino.
Yes,
the Chino group that went up there.
It seems rather ridiculous. That problem, Mr. Hoffman, you knew up, or did you know about that in the first place?
Well, I hear little rumblings about it. I don't know.
It was an accident upon the Hall Road.
Yeah.
This group went from, the volunteer group went up there.
Yeah, and the paid group.
80 miles or 100 miles or something. Right. Distance.
Guys sitting in the fire department, you know, oh, we can't do it, we get paid. That's kind of thing always the same way they have to do it.
We don't have that problem. The municipality of Anchorage is real good about responding outside its boundaries when there's a problem, and it's, for the most part, the people in this part of the country respond to wherever the need is, and it's generally a very good response, very cooperative. We're not faced with the budgetary problems that the city of Fairbanks has.
I don't know if there's a budgetary problem. I think it's, at least I always understood in the past, it was an insurance problem. You know, they go outside the boundaries to respond to something, and then they get a call from inside their boundaries, and they can't respond because the fire vehicles or the, in this case, I guess the emergency vehicles are tied up somewhere else, and they're subject to suit. That's my understanding.
I think there's a provision in the statute that, in statutes that provides, that allows ambulances to respond outside their boundaries. You know, their municipal boundaries, and I don't know if that, what implication that would have in this case. But I remember when that was enacted in the law, I don't remember exactly where. It's with a bunch of other things that municipalities are allowed to do outside of their boundaries.
Well, Anchorage certainly has had this problem in the past, but I think it's
getting more questions.
Fire the Indian Street boundaries, one time with a big fire on 5 Green, and the city responded to it, but they wouldn't shoot more.
Okay, anything else, Mr. Scott?
That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, sorry.
You said you had one nurse on staff who does continuing education development. Could you explain a little more about that? We've gotten a lot of information during the interim that many people in the state felt that there was so little continuing education available to them that they were
This is a new position that we've just established this year. The responsibility is to go around to all of the facilities in the area, do a needs assessment, and then develop a continuing ed plan. We hope to continue a program which we started with Providence this year, where they had an outreach worker in a thermal unit who was available to travel to communities. We provided the travel funds to go to the communities and provide continuing ed and burn care and thermal at General Colton. She did a lot. She did a fantastic job. Just the communities loved it. And the response that we've had so far to our staff person in doing this need is just one of sheer hunger for continuing ed. And I think we're going to be able to meet a significant part of that demand in the emergency and critical care area over the years, but it really does need an organized approach from somebody doing it full time to coordinate it. School nursing has tried it off and on and with mixed results. I think because our scope is so focused that we will be able to pull it off a little better.
Okay, so this is just for the region that you're...
For our region, but each of the three...
The other regions?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, we're the last ones to get on board with something like this.
That did bring a question up that I had, and I just sort of assumed that it was an internal situation, but since I have a chance, I'll ask it. About a week ago in the interior, the Northern Council voted to look at segmenting into the interior region and into another region that's yet to be defined.
Kotzebue and Barrow is to Anchorage for the most part, and a person based here would be better able to meet those needs. How that's done is, I'm waiting for them to, they're still looking at maybe involving the Norton Sound area in their region and discussing their options, but I've already told them that I'm ready to discuss anything with them about providing those services. We traditionally have done the training in those areas as well, the basic EMT training.
That was my next question, which is, would you need an additional person? Should this come up, would you be asking for an additional person?
We probably would be.
But you won't have, this won't be, this decision, as I understand it, will not be finalized until sometime in the spring, or maybe, I guess they had like 6 months to think it over.
Right.
So it would be the next budget process, probably.
We'll be submitting our operating budget in the spring of this year for the coming year, and hopefully it will be, they will have made that decision, or at least made enough of a decision where we can include them in the planning at that time, if that's, they choose to come to us.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else waiting to talk? We'll wait just a few minutes in case anybody comes in. If nobody does, we'll adjourn.
Mm-hmm. 18 minutes of blank tape.